So you've heard the numbers in the news and the glaring scope of addiction in America, but this hour is about how we do right by our friends and our family. You see, the story is about the people who rack up DUI after DUI, but this hour is about those of us who call them brother or sister, or mom or dad. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Kate Archer-Kent, and our guest this hour specializes in family counseling and substance abuse disorders. We invite you to join in with your questions about caring for a person with an addiction or your stories about trying to love someone with an addiction. Join us. 1-800-642-1234 is our number, or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest for the hour is Sophie Hipke. She's a counselor who specializes in substance abuse disorders, family conflict, and mental illness. She works in Green Bay and Menasha with a nonprofit clinic, Family Services. Sophie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with the numbers. Federal estimates say over 375,000 people in Wisconsin report having a substance use disorder. And yet that's just a fraction of it, because as I understand it, therapists, other healthcare providers refer to addiction as a family disease. So it's a whole lot more than 375,000 then in Wisconsin, isn't it?
Yeah, there are a lot of statistics saying that at least one in three households suffer from addiction or are exposed to it in some way. So it's definitely impacting more than just the individual themselves.
And what about, it's hard to ignore Wisconsin has a drinking culture or a drinking identity or is associated with beer, as we've talked about the beer district in the last hour. In your work, Sophie, how do you see where we are in this country, where the identity of Wisconsin playing a role in substance abuse disorders?
Yeah, alcohol is definitely a big issue in Wisconsin. And I think what's hard about our state in particular is that I think addiction is definitely underreported, because it's binge drinking is so celebrated here. So it's become a pretty normal part of our society. I think what I see for our women, particularly in women's recovery journey, is there's a lot of shame. And I think there's a lot of, like, for lack of a better word, peer pressure around choosing not to drink. And people around them really can't understand why they can't just have one, or they call them a party pooper. So I think there's a lot of pressure here, and there's a lot of exposure, right? You can't walk anywhere without seeing alcohol. So I think it makes it really hard for people, particularly in recovery from alcohol in Wisconsin.
So lay it out for us, Sophie Hipke. Why can't they have just one?
I think it's different for everyone, right? So I think we don't want a one-size-fits-all approach for recovery. But for a lot of people in recovery, it's once you get the one, it is really, really hard to stop. It goes immediately to our brain, and our brains say, hey, this is the coping skill that I really liked, that worked really well. And our brain craves more of it. So for a lot of people, when they get just one taste of it, they struggle to stop. Now, for some people, they can do it, and that's great. But I think for a lot of people, especially early on in recovery, it can't stop at one.
And that's the disease, isn't it, Sophie?
Yes. Yeah. It's largely brain-based, yeah. Because the people's brains become so used to having that as a go-to coping skill that in the short term works really well, right? Like, people can ignore a lot of things when they are impaired.
Yeah. Sophie Hipke, our guest, counselor working in Green Bay and Menasha, specializing in family counseling and substance abuse disorders. And welcome your stories this morning, because they may be helpful to others, at 1-800-642-1234. Question I always have, Sophie, is how you even approach somebody about their use or abuse of substances, how you even begin as somebody who loves another person to express concern in a way that doesn't chase them away. How do I even begin to approach somebody with my concerns about substance abuse?
Yeah, I think it's a tough thing, because I think about shows like Intervention, where people gather in a room and they just tell the person how badly they've hurt, you know, their family members. And I think the most important piece is that, like you said, we don't want to chase them away. So I think using any approach like that, where we're piling shame onto this person, is really not going to be helpful, because a lot of times they have a lot of shame like that they give themselves. So I always think about, you know, just for family members to notice with their loved one, like, hey, this is what I'm seeing. Like I'm seeing X, Y, or Z consequence of your use, or I'm worried about, I'm noticing that you're starting to use more, or that these, like that these behaviors or that these things aren't adding up. Like if we're noticing a lot of avoidance behaviors or people lying, I think just expressing concern for the person is our best option.
And so the other aspect, Sophie, that I've come across is an optimism bias and this almost denial that there couldn't possibly be abusing and you know, it's just a use and it's just occasional. What about, you know, overcoming our own optimism and facing the truth and reality about potential substance abuse of our loved ones?
Yeah, I think that is really common. I think, I mean, like we're talking about, right, especially in Wisconsin with alcohol use. But I think what I always think about what separates, you know, like casual substance use or like social substance use from substance use disorders really comes down to like people's, whether or not it's getting in the way of responsibilities. So things like work, social obligations, parenting. So if it's starting to get in the way of people's responsibilities, or based on like withdrawal symptoms. So if they are, I mean, in Wisconsin, we call it a hangover. So if those things are really starting to get significant and they're missing work because they are hungover from a night of drinking. And I think just also a big piece is how often are people using? There are, you know, recommended limits for how many drinks that we're supposed to use in a sitting. Or so I think the biggest pieces I always look at are like our responsibilities, the how often that people are using, and then also what happens when they're not using.
Yeah. Sophie Hipke, licensed professional counselor in training, specializes in substance abuse disorders and family conflict, as well as mental illness. Take your calls this morning at 1-800-642-1234. And before we get to those calls and questions, the other aspect and something that, you know, I'm personally interested in is the feeling that somebody struggling with an addiction is actually choosing the substance over their loved ones, over me. And how do you deal with that sense that, well, they're just choosing that, you know, they're choosing that drug over me?
Yeah, I think that's a really common thing that I hear in either in sessions with family members or that clients report that their family members have said. And I think for a lot of, I mean, one of the ways that I like to explain addiction to either family members or even to people early on in recovery is like to imagine that you had like the very best ice cream sundae that you could ever possibly imagine. And that it's like got all of your favorite toppings. It's your favorite flavor. It's everything you've ever wanted. And you got to have that for a while. And then for the rest of your life, you only ever got to have vanilla ice cream. I'm like, vanilla is good,
sure,
but you always are going to be thinking about that amazing ice cream sundae that you had. And so that's how I like to explain addiction, because that's how it works in our brain. Like our brain is given this artificial amount of whatever it may be, like whether it's happiness or calmness that we can't get in everyday life. So it takes, I mean, our brains are really always going to be pulling us to that because it was that amazing ice cream sundae we had instead of just the plain old vanilla. So I think for family members to recognize that it's not somebody choosing a substance over their loved ones. I think it's their brain choosing this ultimate source of whatever positive feelings that they got from that.
I've heard it described like breathing instead of Sundays, that it's breath. The reason they chose it over you is because they were suffocating.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. We're learning about how to support a family member or friend who may be struggling with addiction, how to even approach them in a way that is compassionate and loving in the way that we feel. But the word we keep hearing from our guest, our guide, Sophie Hipke, is shame. And how powerful that can be. And how do we overcome that? We'll continue the conversation here, and we invite you to join in with your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and let's get right back to our conversation with Sophie Hipke, our guest, our guide, who works for the nonprofit clinic Family Services. And we're talking about addiction and how it can affect relationships with friends and family. This role that shame plays in all of this. Would be interested in knowing your perspective and invite you to join in with your questions and your experiences when it comes to dealing with addiction or loved ones who are doing the same. 1-800-642-1234 to join us or email ideas@WPR.org. And before we get back to my questions, let's get to some of yours. We'll go to Carl first, who's in Great Falls, Montana this morning. Carl, you're on the air with Sophie Hipke.
Thank you. One of the great programs in the country, The Morning Show.
Thank you.
I'd like to say this. I was involved with what I call a substance connoisseur, which would be prescription and street drugs. He was very well aware of them all, and it actually owns your life, addiction, and it's pretty tough.
Wait, when you say, hold on, Carl, when you say it owns your life, did it own, you weren't the addict, your partner was, but did it own your life too?
No, I was too well regarded to the fact that I could not be sucked into the vortex of total addiction of his, because I'm not an addict, but I always worked with him when he wanted to get into the right appropriate treatment and so forth, which was the most difficult for him to endure. And he actually came to me, and we checked into the Huntsman, which is now the Huntsman Mental Health Facility in regards to addiction and all the mental health in regards to addiction. He was there for several days, and he hopped out of it because his opiate demand was too high.
Yeah. And I'm sorry to hear that. Was it a struggle for you, Carl, to find that fine line between empathizing and enabling? Were you concerned about, you know, whether or not your love was the right kind of love for your partner?
It was the right kind of love because I was there for him when he needed me for his recovery. But you can only go so far before you start getting sucked into the vortex of no return. And what will take addicts much worse than you do is other supporting addicts. Other supporting addicts are the toughest people to overcome when you're not the addict, because addicts are their moral support. And if you don't have the strong support behind you of his recovery, you won't win.
Carl, I thank you so much for sharing your story. And Sophie Hipke, I will ask you what you hear from Carl's experience of not being an addict, but being a partner of one who was.
Well, I think, Carl, I think that your approach to it is truly amazing, right? Because I think that we, as loved ones of somebody suffering with addiction, we try so hard, I think, to control it and to force people to make changes. And it sounds like you really understood, like, hey, I can't force this, but I'm here to support you when you're ready, which I think is the best thing that we can do for our loved ones. Is just, they have to want it for themselves in order for it to last.
You can't force this. And but you want to make them do it. I mean, it may save their life, but you can't force this. It feels like you're stuck between a rock and a hard place, Sophie.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a very, the word that I always think about is helpless. Like, I think it's a very helpless place to be for a loved one, because you can see what people need. Like, we can see, hey, you need treatment. And we experience it as professionals too, right? Like, we can see this is what we need. But if we're trying to force somebody into something before they're ready, I don't know how long the change typically lasts. Like, I think we can do things to get them on board. But long-term, people have to want change for themselves.
Yeah. We're talking about addiction and the lasting impact it has on families, whether that is active addiction, treatment, or recovery. And Carl, thank you so much for the call and your story. Sophie Hipke is a licensed professional counselor in training. She specializes in substance abuse disorders, family conflict, as well as mental wellness. And we invite you to share your stories as well at 1-800-642-1234. This morning, where Kathy is standing by in Milwaukee. Kathy, good morning. You're on the air with Sophie Hipke.
Hello. Yeah, I just wanted to say that, you know, I have a spouse that's been in recovery for 30 years from alcohol addiction. And I was kind of, when Sophie said that, you know, some of the signs are, maybe they're missing work. And to me, there's plenty of functional alcoholics out there. So that's one way, but I don't think that's, you know, the tell-all. Also, I was thinking, you know, there's different approaches for different people. Like, you know, when we talk about interventions, you know, yeah, shame I don't believe is very helpful. But some people, you have to approach it like if it hits them financially, that might be important to them. It might be legal consequences and other wounds or trauma. And I think that we have to always keep that in our head and approach each person differently. You know, respectfully, of course. And there is a point where you cannot sometimes do anything and you have to remove yourself from that situation.
When you're starting to talk about financial and legal penalties and trying to coerce or, you know, deal with addiction in this way, while at the same time saying that you're loving this person, I mean, it feels like really tough love, doesn't it, Kathy?
Oh, it definitely is. But I'm saying those are the natural consequences that might affect them. Like, you know, some people can, you know, go through and have all these family, you know, dysfunction things. But when it starts to hit them financially, then all of a sudden they might look at it differently or, you know, they're pending jail or if you approach them like on an emotional, you know, from traumas and wounds, you know, wounds from throughout, who knows, childhood, whatever. I just think those are different approaches than to either intervention or, you know, begging or, you know, trying to help them so much that, you know, they just, it gives them, if you try too hard, it gives them something to fight against and it's a distraction.
Yeah. Kathy, I thank you so much. Yeah. Trying too hard could provoke the other reaction. And Sophie Hipke, when you hear stories about functional alcoholics in a state like Wisconsin, from your perspective and expertise, what do you hear?
Yeah. I mean, I think, like you said, Kathy, I think it's hard because I think people have this idea of what addiction looks like, that it's, you know, I don't know. I hear a lot of like, you know, I'm not that bad. Like I still have my job. I still have my family. I still have these positive things going for me. So I think people, it's really hard because people can sometimes, you know, kind of diminish the actual impact that it's having on people. And I think you're right. I think it's different for, you know, some people of what is kind of the wake up call of that. I need something different. For some people, it is that financial. For some people, it's legal. But for some people, it's not the first one that like causes it to click in their brain that something needs to be different. So I think it can be hard as a family member of somebody who isn't having a lot of natural consequences to their behaviors, because it's hard to then, you know, show, you know, I guess get people the help that they need because they don't see it as an issue.
So I want to follow up on this. And Kathy, thank you so much for calling this morning at 1-800-642-1234. When you're talking about addiction in Wisconsin, in another recent program about addiction, we heard from Jody in Door County. And Jody talked about feeling isolated as a person living with an alcoholic. Let's listen.
We can't easily relate to other people at any time because of the shame of what's going on in our household, or the feelings of guilt or inability to do something.
Sophie, there's the word shame coming up once again. It seems to be a central tenet when we're talking about dealing with addiction. What's your advice to people like Jody who might feel this shame and guilt so overwhelmingly?
The best thing that I would recommend for people in Jody's position would be to seek out, there are support groups such as Al-Anon that are specifically geared towards loved ones of people dealing with addiction, because I think it's so heartbreaking, right, to hear from Jody, because I think it can be such an isolating place. And not only is shame present for the person with addiction, but I think it can be very present for family members, because there's a lot of, you know, I equate it kind of like to victims of domestic violence too, right? Like, why would you stay with this person? And I think for family members, it feels like no matter what they pick, it's wrong. So I think just being able to have her connected with people who are in a similar position can be so powerful.
You're not alone. You're never alone. And as I understand it, Sophie, and we're coming up against the news here so briefly, but as I understand it, addiction exists in isolation, and isolation is the sort of petri dish that can breed addiction.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that about a lot of, you know, a lot of different things that create shame for us, but it thrives in secrecy.
Sophie Hipke provides counseling in Green Bay and Menasha for a nonprofit clinic called Family Services. And we're taking your questions and hearing your stories about addiction for the full hour. News update is next. Then our conversation about addiction continues. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us ideas at WPR.org. If you've come across stories like these before, if you've had to deal with addiction with your loved ones and friends, join us. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Good morning. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're discussing how addiction affects people in Wisconsin beyond the individual person struggling with addiction, family members and friends, loved ones. Our guide this hour is Sophie Hipke from the nonprofit clinic Family Services, and she provides counseling support to families in Green Bay and Menasha. We welcome you to our conversation with your questions, your shared stories and experiences at 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas at WPR.org. I got an email here from Steve and Madison, Sophie, and they say their partner continues to smoke cigarettes. Strong physical addiction. Continued to smoke cigarettes after being diagnosed with COPD. Continued to smoke cigarettes following lung surgery. And Steve from Madison is asking you how to love the person that's killing the love of my life. In essence, the person that's slowly killing themselves.
Yeah. I think it's so hard. Nicotine actually statistically is one of the most addictive substances. So it's
and deadly. Really,
yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's really hard, especially when you're seeing, right, like for in front of your own eyes, your deteriorating loved one. And I think it's just, I wish I had a magical answer for that, I guess. I think it's just really supporting that person. And, you know, I think we can point out all day. And my guess is that his partner is recognizing that this is killing them. But I think they probably feel like it might be at this point that what's the point of changing it? I already have all these consequences. So I think it's just, I think it's always important in addiction of any sort to recognize that like a person is not their behavior. It's very hard to separate those things. I totally get that. But I think as much as we can, trying to recognize that, you know, this person is dealing with an addiction. I think for some people, it feels like a little less, like you said, deadly. I think it for people with smoking cigarettes, it seems not as big of a deal. But it's like he's saying, it's killing her.
Yeah, and it's still a physical addiction. It's a strong physical addiction that'll make you feel like you are going to die if you don't have a cigarette. It'll make you feel that way. It goes back to our conversation earlier, Sophie, about how to deal with the fact that it feels as though your loved one is choosing a substance over you, which is not the case. It's just the way you feel, and your feeling's valid, but it's also temporary. I have another note here from Brittany, from Appleton, who says their younger sister is coming up on 5 years of struggling with an addiction. And Brittany says it's difficult for a sister to keep a job and that their sibling faces social anxiety, severe social anxiety, while being around others and their family. You've got a sister and you've seen her for 5 years now struggling with an addiction. What do you do, Sophie?
I think a lot of it, again, like I come back to just, I think it was Kathy that said that for every person it's different. So I think it's hard to give this one size fits all potential intervention for our loved ones. But I always think about just noticing with our loved one, like with her sister, just noticing like, hey, I'm seeing all of these things going on for you. I'm seeing you struggling to keep down a job. I'm seeing you struggle, which I would imagine would lead to financial stressors or things like that. I'm really worried about you. So like, is there anything that I can do to help you? Can I help you connect with treatment? I think for some people, it, because there's so much, I know we talk a lot about shame, right? But there's so much shame around addiction. I think sometimes a good way in for family members is to, maybe we can address these mental health issues. Like, we can address the social anxiety, and then we can work on the addiction as they get into treatment.
Well, and so from your perspective and your work, Sophie, how much of when we are dealing with substance abuse disorders, are we really dealing with untreated mental illness, or people attempting to self-treat mental illness, or misdiagnosing their what's happening in their own head?
I would say it's a vast majority of the client. I mean, if not all of the clients that I've worked with, there's mental health going on as well.
Yeah. And while obviously treatment is individualized and it has to be for each person, there does seem to be a central theme here, Sophie Hipke, that I keep hearing from you, in order to avoid the shame, in order to empower the person with an addiction. And that is to say that I see you and I care about you. And it's pretty simple that way. And it's not judgmental in any way. It's just that I see these things about you and I care about you.
Yeah, because I think a lot of times, especially in active addiction, I don't think people are always recognizing how their actions are impacting other people, because they can't, I think a lot of times they can't see that in the moment, or it's not, the brain is so driven to continue using or to, you know, spend that time doing activities in order to get substances. I think a lot of times people don't recognize the impact it's having. So I think to hear that from a loved one, like, I care about you and I'm really worried, can sometimes be that open door.
What about burnout? How do family members who have people with an addiction avoid the burnout of, you know, struggling to find ways to thread that needle to support the one they love?
I think, I think one of the important things to recognize is where we have control and where we don't. And I think as humans, we struggle with that. We can encourage and we can, you know, point out all these things, right? But at the end of the day, it's going to be up to that person, whether or not they are in a space that they can do treatment or in a space that they're able to work on their addiction. So I think for family members to recognize that they can take these steps, but we also want to be careful that we aren't walking into the land of like enabling negative behaviors. So it's a hard line.
We're talking about the impact of an addiction on a family with a counselor who specializes in substance abuse disorders, family conflict, and mental wellness, which all have a nexus here this hour. Sophie Hipke is a licensed professional counselor in training at the nonprofit Family Services in Northeast Wisconsin. And if you have stories to share or have questions about how to approach your loved ones, 1-800-642-1234 to join us, or emails available ideas at WPR.org. And back in March, we had, I remember this, Pete from Green Bay called into the morning show and described having a son in his 20s, and the son wanted to start detoxing off of opioids in an emergency room setting. Let's listen.
I've taken him in where he's wanted to go in and tried to get him to detox at a couple different places, went through the emergency rooms at a couple different places, and the emergency rooms will not take opioid addiction for detox. Their thoughts are that, you know, they'll get them in there for 72 hours and then, you know, they leave the hospital back to using again.
Another number for you here, Sophie. Federal health officials say around 90% of Americans who need drug or alcohol treatment do not receive it. What are some of the barriers that families like Pete's family are finding when it comes to trying to find help?
I think a lot of it is, particularly with addiction, we kind of had to act pretty quickly. When somebody who's in active addiction says that they want help, we have to act pretty quickly to get them into treatment. And unfortunately, with a lot of places, there's long wait times, they're understaffed. So I think that's a big barrier that people experience, is that, you know, by the time they say that they want treatment and when they're actually able to get in, they may have, you know, gone back into using, or something else may have happened. So I think that's a big piece. I think another one is funding, right? Like, I know things like 30-day programs or any sort of residential treatment can be really expensive. And insurance doesn't always, for a lot of places, residential treatment, insurance will sometimes cover the treatment, but not like the room and board, and that's expensive. So I think availability of services is a big thing, and also financial barriers are huge.
Well, Matt from Madison sent us an email this morning at ideas@WPR.org saying that we should tax alcohol more and that this money should be used to help people struggling with alcohol abuse. And it seems like, at least from your perspective, Sophie, as a counselor working in Green Bay and Menasha, specializing in family therapy and substance abuse disorder, family counseling and substance abuse disorders, that access to help is just not readily available, immediately available, and there's not enough of it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I know that, you know, our state in particular has recognized that, and they're starting to try to provide services. So the program I work for, Women's Recovery Journey, we're a grant funded program through the state. So they are, I think, recognizing this need, and especially since the pandemic, right? Like that the numbers have gone up so high. Mm-hmm. I think they are recognizing it, but there definitely is a need and especially rural communities, right? Like I'm here in Green Bay and we have a lot of options for treatment, but it's not true in other areas of our state.
Yeah. 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation with our guest, Sophie Hipke. Let's go to Jenny in Stevens Point this morning. Jenny, good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to say I'm a recovering addict. I have been in recovery for about 6 years. I actually met somebody in recovery and they relapsed, and I have seen the other side. I've seen what it's like, what the families have gone through. And it just, I thought I understood when I first got into recovery, and you just never really know the damage you're making. So I just wanted to say that.
I appreciate your story, and I am proud of your recovery, Jenny, and putting the work in. And it sounds like, you know, being caring for somebody with an addiction at times may have been more difficult than being an addict itself.
Oh, 100%.
Oh, wow.
You just get numb when you're in addiction. You do. And you don't realize the ripples that you're having with everybody around you.
So if somebody's listening this morning, Jenny, and they recognize that they may be struggling with a substance abuse disorder, since you've been on the other side of this thing for 6 years, what do you have to say about what's waiting for them as they work their way through recovery?
I'm 38 years old. I didn't get into recovery until I was 32, and I was in addiction for over 10 years. Like 15 years easily. There's always a chance to recover. I'm in school. I run marathons now. there's always a chance to change. It's never too late.
Proud of you, Jenny. Thank you so much for sharing this morning. Let's go to Marley in Brown Deer. Marley, good morning. You're on with Sophie Hipke, licensed professional counselor in training with the Nonprofit Family Services in Northeast Wisconsin.
Thank you. I am just wondering if I have someone who's got a substance abuse problem, if that person can be or comes to the point of wanting help, they have no health insurance. And I'm just wondering what options might be available because...
Marley, what substances are they struggling with?
Alcohol, weed. And I know it's supposedly not addictive, but I'll tell you what, it is, in psychologically at least.
Yeah, yeah.
And I suspect there's more, but I don't know.
Marley, thank you. And Sophie Hipke, no health insurance. What options are available in Southeast Wisconsin for somebody who's struggling with a substance use disorder?
Marley, my best recommendation would be 211 Wisconsin is a resource that connects people with treatment options. Like I mentioned about my program that I work with, we're grant funded. And I know that there are other grant funded programs in the state where if somebody doesn't have insurance, then that's not an issue. My other thought is for some people, like we'll connect them with resources that can get them signed up for things like Medicaid, so that they can have access to treatment. But 211 Wisconsin would be a great resource, and they have a ton of information. You can just call that on your phone and just you say where you are and then what you're looking for, and they can connect you with treatment resources.
And if I'm not mistaken, that Medicaid would cover at least some portion of a detoxification process for alcohol, Sophie?
For most, insurance is super funky, right? But right. most, I know for here in Green Bay, it will. Detox from alcohol, they often, because it can be physically very hazardous, mm-hmm. they will require typically an emergency room situation for medical clearance.
Yeah. And Marley, in the meantime, just keep loving them. And thanks for calling this morning, and continue to take your calls at 1-800-642-1234. As this hour has been about the 1 in 3 estimated households in Wisconsin that are dealing with somebody who is dealing with a substance use disorder. It affects all of us. And there is this central theme of shame and isolation that festers with addiction. But there is also this overcoming addiction that has to do with connecting and empathizing and understanding. I see you and I love you. It starts that way. Now, where does it go from there? I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration helpline number is available anytime. It's 1-800-662-4357. That number is 662-HELP. I'll give it out again here as we approach the end of the hour. It's free. It's confidential. It's always available. 800-662-HELP. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn. Let's get back to talking about addiction with Sophie Hipke, who works for the nonprofit clinic Family Services in Green Bay and Menasha. And there's still time for your questions and stories. 800-642-1234. And for those who have contributed theirs this morning, I thank you for sharing. And I know it's not easy. None of this is. Also know how important it can be. Sophie, I want to ask you about the Women's Recovery Journey, the program that you mentioned before that you work for, and the results that you get. Tell me about some of the women that have worked the program and where they are today.
Yeah, absolutely. We take an approach that we really work with people to heal the whole person. So we do a lot of work with just stability in families, stability in work, stability in the community. So we're a more longer term program. Typically, on average, our clients are with us for about 9 to 12 months. We do groups and individual sessions. So we emphasize that building community and how can we get connected with supports, because like we talked about, you know, it really, addiction really thrives in isolation. So how can we get people connected? We do have success with our program. Addiction is hard, right? So I think we really increase the chance of long-term success with our program because we do focus on so many different aspects of our women's lives. So some of our successful graduates of our program are now, you know, working full time. They have their kids. If their kids have been removed, they're able to be the moms that they want to be. We have clients that have reported back to us about, you know, how helpful it is. Unfortunately, we don't always get to hear back, right, from our success stories. Right. They go on and live their lives, which is great. But they, towards the end of our program, they are doing so fantastic. So it's really cool to see.
Another number that helps contextualize the personal stories is that the National Institute on Drug Abuse says 85% of people relapse within 1 year. And so if you're loving somebody who has a substance use disorder, gets into a recovery program, and then finds themselves, like almost everybody does, relapsing, how are you to respond?
I think for our clients, like some of the most helpful things that they hear, right, is just that normalization of the process. And, you know, I think about things like even weight loss, right? Like when people are on a weight loss journey, how often do they, you know, relapse on eating, you know, junk food? So I think it's really the same thing. So I think for family members, loved ones, to just kind of normalize that and recognize that for some people, it's part of the process. Again, like I come back to the ice cream thing, right? Like you might relapse and you want that really, really good ice cream sundae that you had, and that's okay. And it's not so much focusing on the relapse, but what do we do afterwards? How do we get back on our recovery train? So focusing more on that than on the relapse itself.
Let's go to Don in Minnesota this morning. Don, you're on the air with Sophie Hipke.
Good morning. Very difficult phone call for me, but it's part of my recovery. I'm 70 years old, and I just wanted to share my progression. I was a recreational drug user in the 70s, and I had a horrific accident about 10 years ago, and they pumped me full of Oxycontin and told me it was not addictive, and I felt so good taking it that they were issuing me 100 pills a month at 20 milligrams a pop, and I was up to 5 a day. And the way I can describe this, and everyone asks an addict, what happened? How would you describe an addiction? Well, addiction is different for everybody. But here's how I summarized it. I needed the pain medicine tremendously bad when I had my accidents. And then the need changed to a want. And then the want changed back to a need. Mm. So I was physically addicted to it. So it went, again, from a need to a want to a need. And I was so embarrassed by it because I've been a successful businessman all my life. And I locked myself into a bedroom. And my girlfriend at the time, I said, no matter what I tell you, don't promise you anything. Do not give me any pain pills. Flush everything down the toilet. I went through a week where my hair hurt. But I came out of it, and I said, oh, I made it. I made it. Mm-hmm. Well, what happened is I got involved with methamphetamine because it made me feel better and young again. And that was another they say it's not addictive.
Where are you today in your process of recovery, Don?
I've been sober 10 days.
Yeah.
And I've been through several rehabs to no avail. When I went into these mass production programs, half the people in there were still using. Yeah. And they were so disingenuous. I knew why they were there. So that didn't work for me. I made the decision 10 days ago. I've had it because of the physical damage that it's done to me. And I haven't heard that mentioned. I've heard the emotional, the financial, but the physical toll. Yeah, it tears your soul out. It tears your liver out. It tears your kidneys out. And those things, if the other things don't, your family or if every emotional doesn't bother you, your physical self and watch yourself dying. That's what it took for me. And thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to share what I went through. It's part of my self recovery.
Yep. Keep putting in the work, Don.
I can't do this alone.
Thank you so much for sharing this morning. Sophie Hipke, we are out of time, but this is a wonderful place to land as this conversation continues. Thank you so much for being a part of it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Sophie Hipke is a licensed professional counselor in training, specializing in substance abuse disorders, family conflict, and mental wellness, working in the nonprofit clinic called Family Services in Green Bay and Menasha. Listen, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration helpline number is 1-800-662-4357. That's 1-800-662-HELP. It is free, it is confidential, and it is there for you anytime you need it. 1-800-662-HELP. We also have a link to the agency's website at wpr.org/mornings. Thank you for being a part of it. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kenton today, and you are listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.